Interrobang.
From catschool.net, I'm Dave DeGraw, and you're listening to Interrobang. If you'd like to watch a video of this show, look up CatSchool on YouTube or go to catschool.net/podcast, where I'll have the video embedded as well. If you'd like to listen to this and you're watching the video, you can search Interrobang on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else that you find your podcasts and follow the show. If you feel so inclined, you can like and rate the show, but honestly, I am just happy that you're listening at all. Today, I am joined by a very special guest. Gabe runs the YouTube channel Save It for Parts, where he has an eclectic collection of videos about various topics. If you're a nerd like I am and you're listening to the show, you'll probably find pretty interesting everything from weather satellites to building DIY vehicles, recycling anything and everything he can get his hands on, from a geodesic dome to a monorail to random smaller accessories, anything he can get his hands on. Gabe grew up extremely self-sufficiently in a remote Alaskan community, and he's taken that ethos and ideology with him through his adult life. I had a great time talking to Gabe. Let's get right into it. Welcome back to Interrobang. Today I'm joined by my buddy Gabe. Gabe runs the YouTube channel Save It for Parts and also has a blog, saveitforparts.com, which implies that the name Save It for Parts predates your involvement with YouTube. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's I've kind of been doing Save It for Parts since I was a kid. That was a kind of a motto, apparently, when I was a child. My mom said that somebody stepped on some toys when I was a kid, and she was going to go throw them away. And I said, no, Save It for Parts. And that was kind of how I lived my whole life, I guess. So it's been a motto of mine for a while.
That's very cool. I actually think you have a video on your channel where, and remind me, it's like this certain brand of like West German toys that I think you talk about on your channel, but specifically, I think that was the toy that got crushed that you wanted to save it for parts.
Yeah, it was. I found them later, actually. It was something I had kind of forgotten about, and then. It was a Brooder, I think, was the brand, and it was these little toy, they were airplanes, cars, and boats, and they came in about, you know, each toy was made of about four or five different little plastic molds, and they were all different pieces, so you can kind of mix and match the color combos, and they were the kind of thing, like, when you went to the dentist, they would have a jar of these on the counter, and they'd give you one of these little toys, and I haven't seen them for quite a while. I guess they were big in the 90s, and for some reason, I had quite a few of them, and you'd step on them, you'd break it, but you know, you could just swap those parts out really easily, and you'd have spare parts for the different little planes and boats and stuff. So I think that's the exact toy that it came from.
And you talk a lot about growing up on a remote island in Alaska, and so I anticipate that a lot of the Save It for Parts mentality. I mean, you were probably just regurgitating what your parents and your family had to live by out of necessity. Is that kind of accurate?
Yeah. So I grew up just outside of Juneau, so on Admiralty Island. It was about a 3-hour trip to the biggest town, to Juneau, and then a 15-minute plane ride if we could afford a plane. But that was kind of a rare. That was for special occasions, basically a few times a year. So. Basically, yeah, anything that we had, you had to make it last. If you broke it, you had to either fix it or save it to use for spare parts. And that was basically a lot of how I grew up and all of our few neighbors. We had about 10 year-round residents in that town, so it was a pretty small ghost town, basically, where I lived. So
yeah, well, and for the listener, the viewer of this podcast that maybe is not familiar with Gabe's channel, recently you rented a not a houseboat, but a large, I don't know, you can tell me the technical term of the kind of boat, but you rented a boat with a couple of friends, and you went and visited, and I believe it's Funter Bay, that's where, so you went back and visited the island, and you have a tour of the old cannery, salmon cannery, mining operations. But then I really liked, you're like, oh yeah, this is where like my neighbor, I don't remember his name, but my neighbor Bill, who lived on the island, he was an old guy. And it's just like, it honestly kind of reminded me of like, I don't know, like a Ghibli movie or something like that. We have all these like only a select few of neighbors, but they're like kind of interesting people. And yeah, I don't know. I thought, if you're not familiar with his channel, definitely go check out those most recent videos on his visit to Alaska, because I really have enjoyed watching those.
Yeah. It was definitely an interesting childhood, and it was fun to get back there. So recently my channel is kind of all over the place. I do, you know, I do boat stuff because I grew up on an island, so I always enjoyed boats. And then I do a lot of radio and ham radio satellite stuff. But yeah, like you said, recently we rented this boat. It was a 42-foot Nordic tug, so it's a kind of a tugboat style yacht, essentially a passenger boat, and 7 people total. So we were crammed in there a little bit, but that made it affordable for our group. And yeah, we went back to my old hometown. My sister and I, she actually drives tugboats professionally now, so cool. She's a commercial tugboat captain. And yeah, we had enough boating experience that the rental place said, yeah, we'll just give you this 42-foot boat basically without meeting you. And they met us to do the walkthrough, but they had let us be our own captain. And yeah, that, you know, I call it a town. It had a post office probably in the, you know, the 70s, but it's not really a town anymore. It's a ghost town. So there's an abandoned cannery, an old mining camp, old gold mines. And yeah, you really did get to know all the neighbors very, very well, and people from all walks of life. You know, we had, my parents were kind of hippies. We had very kind of redneck rail neighbors. We had very interesting neighbors of different types. We had retired folks. We had old time kind of Alaskan sourdoughs that you'd think of as the real old timers. And so it was a very very interesting little community when I was a kid. So
I don't think I saw, but like, what was it initially that took your family up to Alaska? Are your parents from there, or was this kind of an experiment, or what was the deal with that?
I guess a little bit of an experiment. My folks grew up, they both grew up in kind of Los Angeles suburbs basically. And my dad came up kind of being a hippie, basically just doing kind of odd jobs. And he stumbled into commercial fishing and then ended up finding this little property, worked for the guy that owned the gold mine for a little bit, just doing surveying and doing some different things, worked for the Forest Service for a bit. And then, he had this little property, and my mom came up and joined him, and they basically built up this property from a shack on the beach to a nice family home. And a lot of subsistence living. My dad fished commercially, so he would go out in the summers and troll for salmon, and then my mom would do some, she had like a crab license, so she would catch crab, not on the deadliest catch scale, just out of a little skiff, for sale locally. And then we ended up eating a lot of seafood and deer and garden vegetables and that sort of thing. So pretty off-grid living.
Wow. So you grew up there. Is that where your memory begins? And then you lived there until you left and went to the University of Alaska at Fairbanks?
Yeah. I had done high school in Sitka, which was another town nearby. So we were homeschooled. My sister and I were homeschooled up until high school, and it was a state-run kind of correspondence program. So not like a religious homeschool. It was just a state program for kids who lived in logging camps or fishing villages or places without schools. And then for high school, the state had a boarding school that was very similar. So it was like kids from native villages, kids from outlying areas. I was a minority at the high school because it was a lot of Alaska Native kids. It was a lot of people from, just these small towns like that, that had no school district or no school building in their town. So, and then off to University of Alaska Fairbanks. And then I went to grad school down here in Minnesota, which is where I live now. And I ended up with more kind of social connections down here, because that, like, the thing in Alaska is you grow up, and then unless you work, there's very few jobs, I guess, for young people, unless you want to be a fisherman, if you want to go work in the oil industry, and that's kind of not for everybody. So I ended up with more social connections down here in the down south part of the U.S., as we'd call it. So.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it makes sense. Like, it seems like, because I'm sitting here thinking, it's like, well, you know, today we have like remote work and things like that. And I noticed you have a master's degree in computer science, But it's like, it seems like, yeah, like to have a lifestyle like that, it's like, that almost is your job. It almost seems like it's like, it's not, yeah. I don't know. Like I recently resigned from my position as a staff software engineer, and it kind of like, it became like, okay, I have this job to support this lifestyle, and living up there the way your parents did, it almost seems like, look, we have a lifestyle and we're going to support it with whatever jobs we can do. And so if you're not dedicated and passionate enough about that lifestyle, it, yeah, it's probably a lot just kind of, I don't want to say easier, but just, kind of just more simple to live in the normal world kind of down in Minnesota, right?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, I definitely enjoyed it. I mean, I worked for my dad for a while. I did some commercial fishing, and I did a variety of jobs up in Alaska. But yeah, kind of the path I went with the computer science, also the communications were an issue. We didn't have internet until I think when I was in college. We did get finally a satellite internet that was a very early one, very laggy. So we did have some internet, and of course now there's Starlink, but it would have been very hard to have a tech job there. And even in a lot of the larger cities in Alaska, which, you know, the largest city is, I think, maybe 500,000, maybe it's 250,000 now. I can't remember. They're not large. So yeah. There aren't a lot of tech jobs unless you work for the government, or if you work for, kind of the oil industry is the other big employer up there for a lot of things. So that was another reason why I kind of moved down here. And yeah, I mean, nowadays, if you want to live off grid, then there are more opportunities, but you are still, like you say, it's a whole lifestyle. You're spending a lot of time maintaining your property, maintaining your lifestyle, you know, just keeping things operating, keeping things going, keeping yourself supplied. You know, we would have to go to town maybe twice a year in the boat, fill up the boat at Costco, fill up at the oil dock, fill up 55 gallon drums. So you're doing a lot of work that you take for granted living in a city, just to have some of those basic, kind of basic things that you need to live, I guess.
It's interesting. I don't know. I have a couple thoughts on that. Like one is, so I live here in a town called St. George, Utah. It's in southern Utah. We're about 2 hours away from Las Vegas. So if I was like going to take an international flight, I'd go to Vegas, although I don't take international flights because I hate going to Vegas. But when I was a kid, I lived in this little town in Utah that most people have never even heard of called Oak City. My most recent blog post, I talk about it, but it was a small town, about 600. Oh, you saw that? Yeah. 600 people. And so I was there from kind of my memory beginning until first grade. And I don't know. There's a like I said, like there's not even a place to spend money in this town, not like by design. It's just kind of how it shaped out, I guess. And part of me like really misses that kind of more simple lifestyle versus coming down here to the city. And like I said, it's like we have these jobs now that kind of, I don't know, like, are we doing the job to support a lifestyle, or are we living a lifestyle to support a job? And I know you recently resigned from your position as well, and you are doing YouTube full time now, right?
I am, yeah, and that's a little bit of a gamble. I'm about, you know, 300,000 subscribers, give or take, and that is, for me, it's really hard to tell on YouTube. Like, you never really know how much people are making, if there's all kinds of stuff that goes into that with sponsorships and whatnot. But I get all these comments, people say, oh, you're such a big YouTuber, you must be, you know, you can afford all these things like boat trips. And no, 300,000 subscribers, that's kind of minimum wage. And you know, like the boat trip, we've been planning that since, well, 2020, we started planning it, and then, you know, that got put on hold for various reasons. I'm doing YouTube full time. It's a bit of a gamble. I saved up a bit from my prior job just so I could have a backup plan if things don't work, because YouTube is so, it's inconsistent. You know, some months you make nothing, some months you make a lot, and it just depends on what the algorithm wants to do with your stuff and what people want to see. And it's very random. So,
well, and I don't want to cause you anxiety here, but you know, with like the view issue that YouTube is having right now, it's like all the talk. And I noticed it before people even started talking about it. It was like, you're looking at like big, like even like Linus Tech Tips, like one of the biggest channels I subscribe to. And it's like, I'm just looking at his videos and like, whoa, like, holy cow. Like the views are way, way down. I don't think materially, like, I don't know. I have a whole section on my website on my about page. It's just, I called it numbers because, like, numbers piss me off, dude. Like, when you look at Spotify artists and it's like, oh, they have 10,000 monthly active listeners, it's like, analytics and statistics like that, they're meaningless. Like, we use them to tell stories about ourselves. The issue is that advertisers and people that potentially you're trying to work with, you know, they look at that and they're like, well, yes, 300,000 views and his latest video only had 50,000 watches or whatever. And it's like, they use these numbers to attribute meaning, which probably makes it stressful for you. But I was just kind of curious, like, I don't know if I really want to ask you about that, but, like, do you have any thoughts about that whole, like, cause you went full-time YouTube, like, basically the day that whatever change YouTube made happened, right? Like, and in our email correspondence, I mentioned that I really like the Alaska stuff, right? And you had mentioned, well, it doesn't seem to be as quite as popular as the satellite videos. And for me, it's like, I don't, like, I'm honestly not, like, I don't know that much about satellite stuff. Like, I'm not that interested in the satellite videos, but to see the Alaska stuff and the homestead and the boats and stuff, like, I think that's, like, way interesting. So I'm kind of curious, like, what your perspective on that is.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it was surprising to me, and I talk about the YouTube algorithm sometimes being this mysterious, you know, kind of, you're at the whim of this algorithm, of what it pushes, of what it wants to do. And I've said that before, and I've seen that before, where I'll put out a video that I put a ton of effort into, and I think it's really interesting, and I think it's topical, and then it gets no views. And I'll put out one that is just a low effort, kind of, you know, really short, and it'll get tons. And it's just, it's so random of what gets pushed, what people want to see. To some extent, it's what people want to see. So if you do something, if you're the only one doing something, I think that's part of it, which maybe I was the only one doing some of the satellite stuff for a while, which there's other people doing satellite topics, and there's other people doing Alaska topics and other things that I do. But yeah, I never started. I started out doing, like, stuff that I found in the dumpster, fixing things up, at least on YouTube. That was kind of my earliest content for the channel. And the satellite stuff, I was a beginner. I didn't know what I was doing. I was kind of doing it. I was filming it as I was learning. And apparently people really like that, because they want to learn too. And they want to start out and figure out, well, how do we get into this stuff? And apparently I just hit that right, that right level of, like, curious and educational, something like that. So it's, I don't know if that answered your question, but that's what I've experienced with it. So
I was kind of, well, and I guess you kind of touched on it, right? Because you said, like, sometimes I'll make just, like, a kind of low effort, quick video that's, like, super popular. And sometimes it's, like, this huge passion project and nobody watches it. So I was kind of curious, like, are there any things that, like, you wish you could, like, is there any topic you wish people were more interested in watching versus topics that you know people will watch? Does that make sense? Is, like, to what level do you cater the content to the audience versus just, like, look, I'm a dude that's interested in satellites or whatever it is. Ducks. You have videos about ducks, right? Yeah. Or Alaska or whatever it is. Like, so where does that line for you versus, like, look, I'm going to make a video that I know is going to be killer and people will watch, or, like, I have no idea what people are going to want to watch, so I'm just going to make a video about my ducks.
Sure. It's a little of both. I mean, I'll do stuff that I'm interested in, and I have so many interests. I'm a little ADHD. I'm a little, you know, I'll be all over the place on stuff. So, but I also, you know, like you said, the analytics, the numbers, I watch those. I try not to let them run my life. But if I notice the views are sliding, if I notice that, people aren't watching as many, maybe I'll focus more on a satellite video, or I'll try to do one, maybe I'll try to do one that I think will get more views. But it's really hard to tell. So I think having a diversity of content out there, having a lot of different stuff, does help, because maybe the satellite stuff gets, you know, loses popularity, and maybe people shift over to something else in the future. And I feel like having a lot of different stuff, and I've told people this too, when people say that, how do you start out as a YouTuber? How do you, you know, how did I start out? Because I can't speak for everyone, but I said, I just put a bunch of stuff out there, and eventually something stuck. You know, I didn't really have a theme other than cheap dumpster dived kind of redneck projects that I would put together out of trash. That was kind of my theme. And eventually one of them took off, and I would not have predicted that was the one that took off. So I kind of say, be diverse in your content, be have a lot of different things out there. And if one isn't doing so well, maybe another one does.
So what was the video that took off then? Do you remember?
I think, and again, this was probably a timely thing. I did a video on weather satellites, and I think I mentioned Russian weather satellites. Yeah. I think this was right about the time that Russia invaded Ukraine. So it was in the news. It was, everybody was looking up Russia, and then they were like satellites, and it's like, boom, suddenly that hit. And I got a ton of subscribers who now wanted to see more satellite stuff, and that kind of snowballed. So part of it was kind of luck of the draw on, you know, bad luck for the folks in Ukraine, of course, but that was a topical thing that just happened to be in the news at the time. So
interesting. So when you made the, because that, I looked at your channel, and that is the number one most viewed video on your channel. I think it has like 2.1 million views or something like that, which is incredible. Congratulations, by the way. I mean, like, again, we're saying, I don't know, view counts, maybe they matter, maybe they don't, but congratulations on that. You're saying that basically you just like, I mean, you were just like, I don't know, I'm going to listen to some Russian weather satellites and make a video about it. And then it was like, well, it turns out that it's very topical right now, kind of an idea. Like, but your motivation for that was just, I want to make an interesting video about Russian weather satellites.
Yeah. I wasn't, you know, I was paying attention to the news and I wasn't like, yeah, I wasn't trying to cash in on a war. And I, you know, I don't want to downplay what's going on over there because I have a lot of thoughts on that and you don't need to get into that here, but unfortunately, you know, anyway, it was something that just kind of happened.
Yeah.
And on my end of that being something that was in the news. And I think if I did stuff on China, there would be some interest because, you know, China's in the news a lot. If I did other politically or geopolitical topics, I'm sure I could attract more interest. And that's not necessarily something I'm interested in. You know, I just want to be, I'm just curious. I want to see what's out there. I want to look at, you know, satellites and scientific stuff. And kind of, again, unfortunately at the moment, Russia is the one with the weather satellites that you can pick up as an amateur. The U.S. has kind of killed off all of their easily accessible weather satellites. They just shut down the NOAA series. And so if you want to start out as a satellite hobbyist in the U.S. or anywhere in the world, you're kind of looking at Russian stuff. So, cause that's what's there at the moment. So, and there are some more, systems going up. There are other satellites that I could be looking at. And I have a huge to-do list of satellites to look at, but you know, it takes a while to get through them all. So,
wow. So those Russian satellites specifically, are they like, what era? I mean, are they modern era? Are they like, are we talking like crusty Soviet era satellites still spinning around up there or what?
The Meteor series that the ones that are active now, there's Meteor M23 and Meteor M24, and those were launched recently, but they're kind of based on Soviet hardware. And I've heard, and I always get in trouble if I say anything negative, I get all the Russian troll farm bots pop up on my comments and go, oh, you know, everything is fine, comrade. There is no problem with our satellites catching on fire, but you know, they're kind of based on old Soviet hardware, and they do tend to explode from battery issues, and they don't necessarily last very long. So a lot of these Meteor series, you know, like the U.S., the NOAA series, some of those were like, I think, over 20 years old. They had been going well past their design life. And some of those have had battery fires and explosions too. So I, you know, it's not just a Russian issue of space hardware having issues, but the U.S. ones tend to last longer before they fail or fall apart, and the Russian ones tend to last a few years, it seems like. But yeah, they are kind of based on older hardware, but the older ones don't last as long. So I'm not out there listening normally to very old Russian stuff.
I see. Well, I mean, hey, for what it's worth, you're talking to a guy who wishes there was more English language content about antiquated Soviet era technologies and computers and technology. Like, the whole parallel world there is fascinating to me, but we don't have to dive into that because I personally would prefer not to have Russian troll farms come attack me.
Sure.
one thing I noticed, okay, on your website, you listed out your interests, and two of them stuck out to me, okay? Piracy. Now, yeah. Are we talking, like, because you have experience with boating, And I'm assuming that not like RR pirate, but as in like Sailing the Seven Seas, digital piracy.
I mean, a little bit. That was, I think my intro, that might be a leftover again from college. Yeah. My, my interests on the website, because parts of that website are, it's probably parts of it are from high school, because, you know, I grew up in the era, they said in high school, they said, put everything about yourself online and that will help your job prospects, you know, put your entire life on there. And nowadays they're like, no, no, take your entire life off because people are going to steal your identity. So, but yeah, I, you know, I grew up, I had a free sailboat, not stolen, but basically this free, sailboat in Alaska that I fixed up. And, so that was part of it, sailing around, it, you know, hoist the pirate flag, and we'd sail around in that. It was a 24-foot Bayliner Buccaneer was the brand. And it's known as one of the worst mid-sized sailboats, but a lot of people hate it, but I loved it. It was a great boat for me.
How do you pronounce it? Is it, is this the Pagu? The Pagu?
The Pagu, yeah. Pagu. And that was Pagu. And that was based on, if I can find it, I still have the book that that was based on. So this was a book from my childhood about, this author does kind of these really detailed natural histories of a little sea creatures and just interesting stuff, and and really good illustrations. So this one was about a little hermit crab named Pagu, and I think that's, it's based on the Latin name for hermit crabs.
But, I mean, I looked at your Flickr. Yeah. I mean, I looked at the blog post about the Pagu and like the before, like, because I saw the after and I was like, after what, you know? And then I saw the before and I was like, oh my gosh, like, how is that even possible? That thing was like destroyed. I mean, like, it would have just been salvaged, right? It would have just been like wrecked and you fix it up and sailed it around.
Yeah. And that was, I think my dad's backup plan, because the backstory on the sailboat was my dad was fishing out at Elfin Cove, was this little town where we'd fish, which was a slightly larger town than where we lived. You know, it was big enough to have, there was one bar and one general store, and the general store was about, you know, the size of my office here.
Wow.
But there was a little harbor there, and an old timer had died and basically left his old boats rotting at the dock. And the harbor, there wasn't even really a harbor master. There was a guy that kind of did everything in the town. He was kind of the maintenance guy. Anyway, he was trying to get rid of this boat and offered it to me. And I said, you know, I think first it was $100. He said, I want this boat for $100. And I said, no, it's not worth $100. And then he said, do you want this boat for free? I go, oh, yeah, sure, it's worth free. And my dad towed it home. And I think he said it was just terrible to tow because it was just, you know, it was wobbling all over the place. And his plan was if I didn't use it, he was going to cut the keel off because it was like 1,000 pounds of lead on the keel. And he would use that for fishing weights because that lead is pretty valuable as fishing weights. But I fixed it up and rebuilt it to kind of my redneck standards, you know, good enough. It wasn't very pretty, but it was functional when I was done. And yeah, I sailed it back out to Elfin Cove and I'd sailed it into Juneau and poke around on it. So it was it was a fun project. So
is that boat still around or did you get rid of it?
I sold it and it's gone through several hands. I do keep track of it, so it shows up on the Juneau Harbor auctions every few years. Like somebody will abandon it. It gets auctioned to someone else. They use it for a few years and then they abandon. So it's like, yeah, it's like the beginner boat in Juneau that people will use for a few years and then decide they don't want it anymore. So it's, you know, I did see it last time I was in the harbor there in Juneau. Was a few years back. I did see it. I didn't see it this last time when we went up, but we were at a different harbor. So, yeah. So I think it's still in Juneau. I think it's still around.
Wow. Almost sounds like it's like relatively cursed. Like the thing just will not die, even though it like might be begging. But I mean, I'm sure that the work you did on it is a big reason why it's still kicking around, you know? I don't know. Save it for parts. That's your whole ideology.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I, you know, boats tend to last quite a while in Juneau, you know, or in Alaska in general. Again, stuff is expensive. You know, it's expensive to bring things up. There's still old wooden fishing boats. People will keep using them until they basically sink out from under them. In some cases, that happened to somebody next to us once when we were fishing, and they had an old, old wooden boat, and it just finally gave up, and they had the next fishing boat behind them and had to pick them up out of the water. So that happens too.
So I guess with that, one thing I was wondering about, the being self-sufficient up there in Alaska, like what happens, I don't know, like what happened if you broke your leg? I don't know. Did accidents happen? And like what, or I don't know, part of your house catches on fire? I don't know. Like what's the, I don't know. I guess enlighten me there a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely, part of having a small community like that, even of, you know, of our community with 10 people at Funter Bay, that would be everybody looked out for each other, and you had to have, you know, between the whole community, people would have, like, somebody would have a fire pump, and maybe everybody would go in on that fire pump that you could run over if there was a fire. You could throw it in the ocean, hopefully at high tide, because if it's low tide, you've got 100 feet of hose up to the house. And that happened before I was too young to remember, but a neighbor's house burned down and everybody went over there with pumps and tried to save it. Unfortunately, they didn't save that one. But you would have, we would monitor a bunch of radios. We would have a CB radio for kind of the local community. We would monitor Marine VHF, which was technically illegal. You're not supposed to have a Marine VHF in your house, but the Coast Guard really liked that we had that because we were kind of the first responders, essentially. If a boat sank near us, we or somebody in the community could usually get there before the Coast Guard could. And that happened a few times. We'd Wow. have boats sink and they would end up at our house, and then the Coast Guard would come out and pick them up. If somebody, broke a leg or had a health issue, if the weather was good enough, you could get a plane out or a helicopter out to medevac. But if it was a terrible storm, if it was the middle of winter, you would have to just kind of take care of that person until the weather cleared up. So it was a lot of community involvement, a lot of self-sufficiency, but within a slightly larger community. So we were lucky in that respect. We weren't completely out on our own. We weren't, we weren't the only household there for most of my childhood, where these days there aren't as many people there, so it's harder to do that sort of thing.
I would love to kind of dig into that more, because this is something I think about a lot. I think about community. We have this kind of term like online community, right? And I don't know if that's, I mean, I think community disconnect, lack of community, and maybe pouring your time and energy into a community that is not going to be reciprocal of that, which I would say pretty much any digital online. Like, I have friends and people that I know online that I definitely have a community with, but if my house burns down, they can't be there to help spray it, right? Or if I break my leg in the winter, they can't be there to help splint it. So I was kind of curious, like, yeah, I would love to dig into that more. Like, what's your perspective on community and the importance of it and how to build strong communities? Like, because if you have 10 people and I show up, I'm the 11th guy there and I'm like a jerk. Hey, you know, like private property, stay off. I'm just being hard, you know, ornery. That can really screw things up, right? So I was kind of curious. Yeah, like what do you think about that?
Yeah, there would be friction for sure. You know, every now and then there were, you'd get like summer people who would come up. So the community had, you know, 10 year round residents, but there were summer cabins. There were, it would be like, I guess like a vacation place. Like if you're in Minnesota or if you're in the US, there are these vacation lakes that you go to for the weekend or the summer. And then they're the kind of weird people that live there year round. But, I don't want to like blame anyone or cause any drama, but every now and then you would get somebody who's just there for a vacation and they thought it was cool to, you know, leave their trash out where the bears would get it, or, you know, fire guns off at night, or just be kind of annoying. And yeah, that was difficult to, it'd be difficult to kind of integrate that person into a community, especially if they're not there full time. I think usually the long-term people were pretty good about integrating with the existing community, about working together. They found out pretty quickly that it was hard to do things on your own, and that there was a lot of kind of institutional knowledge or local knowledge about, yeah, this is where you want to put your crab pots. This is how you want to build your house or your shed. This is how you interact with the bears. This is, there was a lot of that existing knowledge that really helped out a newcomer. And, you know, my dad found that out when he moved there. The folks who were there long term really showed him, like, okay, yeah, this is how much firewood you need. This is how you do all of these things that are needed to live there. And if you're open to being that, to kind of learning and cooperating, then it really helps you integrate better, and it really helps you just live there better. So
yeah, so almost, I guess what you're saying, okay, so if I'm going to live there year round, like, I need the community, and frankly, the community needs me to some extent. And so we're incentivized to help each other. I mean, I remember I moved into a house once that had a septic tank, and my next door neighbor had lived there for like 30 years. So he had helped all six previous owners of the house empty the septic tank. He knew where it was. It was funny because he was a retired software engineer. So he'd do yard work in his Microsoft Visual Basic 2000 t-shirt. And I would do yard work in my Docker Kubernetes t-shirt, you know? Yeah. but so it's just like that kind of community where it's like, look, dude, like I need you, and I couldn't really offer him a whole lot, but that I definitely have felt that, before. It kind of, yeah, it's very interesting. And I wonder, maybe part of the reason why some people feel a lack of strong communities today is because we have everything taken care of. And like, from a legal perspective, like if my neighbor's house is burning down, I'm kind of like legally like obliged to just kind of let it burn, or let the fire department show up and do their job. Let people do their job, from insurance, whatever it is. But when you're up there, it's like, it's not like it's life or death, right? It makes all the world a difference.
Yeah, and I do feel that somewhat in, I guess, for example, and again, I don't want to cause any drama if any of my neighbors are watching, but I don't feel as connected to some of my neighbors here in the city. It feels like you don't need to know everybody in your neighborhood. Like, I know some of my neighbors, and I'm on, I think, good terms. I know there are some that maybe think I'm a little weird because of my YouTube projects, but it's not... Yeah, it's not as much of a daily thing where you're talking to the neighbors, you're talking to people even in your own community, in your neighborhood, because, yeah, you have stores, you have, you know, you can hire a handyman to come out to fix something if you don't know how to fix it. So you have kind of these other resources in a city, but yes, they do take away from that sense of connectedness to the people right around you. So, so I think you're right about that. It's maybe the bigger the city you're in, the less you're connected to the people in it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, there's pros and cons to having structure and infrastructure and things like that to allow us. I mean, it's like you're saying, it's like you move down to Minnesota, to St. Paul. It's just kind of, I don't want to say easier, but more conducive to a sporadic lifestyle, less committed lifestyle. But at the same time, maybe we do lose some of that connection with our, just because we don't need other people as much. But okay, here's my radical take. I think that we do need other people that much. I think that everybody needs that connection with their community and their surroundings. And I feel very strongly that one of the issues today is that people are replacing that connection with their community with online communities. But online communities, I mean, look, they can be good. Like, by all means, I've been a member of online communities. But you mentioned Russian troll farms. Like, we know that these are things that happen. Bad actors, state-sponsored actors, whatever it is, it's harder to moderate and it's harder to trust. And then again, when your house is burning down, there's nobody there with a pump that can run over and help spray. Like, so I think, I guess what was it like then? Cause like, you grew up and like, this is your entire perspective. It's like, look, I need help. Like, I can go ask my neighbor Bill, who knows how to patch a boat or whatever it is. And then you kind of like start integrating into a bigger society. Was it bizarre, or was that a learning process at all for you to understand this? Like, look, like, not everybody is as committed to this as maybe I think they are, kind of an idea?
Maybe. I guess so part of the reason I moved down here was for community, and I was lucky enough. I was in an online community that had, for a hobby, that had a big presence here in Minnesota, and so when I moved here, I kind of already had a real world social group who I had talked to someone online. And so to some extent, I guess I would say there are some benefits to online communities, especially if you can have that connection to the real world aspect of it, like in a hobby or, you know, something like ham radio, which may be a bad example because I'm not as good at using that. But hobbies where there is an online component and a you know, meet space component, I guess. And then, you know, there are benefits to the online thing, too. Like if your house burns down, there are things like, you know, GoFundMe or, you know, people are willing to chip in the ways that they can from online where they can't in person. So I would say there are some benefits to online communities, and there are definitely some drawbacks. You know, I've moderated forums for some of these big hobbies that I was in, and things can get very heated and very, you know, very contentious for people who you get along with fine in person, but then online they are just terrible trolls. And so it's yeah, it's really a mixture, and it's really I've seen kind of multiple sides of that, I guess. So it's
in your experience, then what makes a strong community, I guess, in general? Do you have any thoughts on that? Online, in person, they're toxic. HOAs are probably some of the most, homeowners associations are probably some of the most toxic organizations, in the States. Right. So like what, in your opinion, what makes a strong community?
I mean, it's definitely shared interests. I think if it's a positive interest, I know there are all kinds of interests, but I would say if there's a shared interest and a shared, not even ethics or beliefs, but maybe a shared kind of experience of the world. Or I don't know if I'm explaining this right, because I've seen stuff that brings together people from just all kinds of diverse communities who maybe have no shared background or have no shared culture, but then in certain aspects of online and offline, they have this kind of connection. And It's really hard for me to say, and I don't know if I could really nail down what the ideal mixture is, but shared struggle is something, I think, if there's a shared kind of maybe goal or dream or objective that you're trying to get to, if you're trying to, you know, preserve something, some historic thing, if you're trying to learn more about some topic, those can be something that brings people together. If you're trying to, you know, if you're just trying to live together in a community or do like a community garden or a community improvement project, just I think these really positive goals and really kind of positive shared objectives are something that really helps, as one example, I guess.
Yeah, so strong kind of purpose, as well as could I say code of conduct? Not that it's like this strict, but like even up there in a 10 person community year round, like there is like a code of conduct that's acceptable and not acceptable, and firing guns off in the middle of the night is not acceptable.
Yeah, and it's not always explicitly stated, you know. It's not always you're not always you don't always agree on politics. You don't always agree on a lot of things, but there is kind of an acceptable, there's this set of expectations that aren't always made explicit. And, and that can be hard for a new person to understand. And sometimes you do kind of, you know, you can teach new people or help new people learn that sort of thing. And new people can bring new perspectives too. So you're not just, like you said, the HOA, you're not always stuck in your ways of what this HOA rules were in the, you know, in the 80s when it was a suburban nightmare. It can grow and it can expand when you have younger people come in, when you have new outlooks and new kind of realities. So that's part of it too, kind of being able to evolve, I guess. That's always been something important too, I think.
Yeah, that is. It must evolve. Yeah. I like that a lot. And I really appreciate you talking about that. I wrote down on my notes, I wrote down hogwash. So you have a sign above your garage that says hogwash. What's the story with hogwash?
Sure. So I go on these online auctions, which not quite like eBay. These are like local auctions. Yeah. Like you'll have, a company goes out of business, all their stuff gets auctioned off. Estate sales are going that way a lot since COVID. People don't want to have a thousand people go through their house, so when a relative dies, they put all their junk on these auctions. And so I go on these online auctions. I bid on weird stuff. And that, I think, was from a, it was from a motorcycle wash. It was like a car wash, but for motorcycles. Yeah. So hog wash.
Oh.
And, you know, hog wash, just, you know, BS, kind of just nonsense. I like nonsense. And I think I paid something like $16 for that. It wasn't much. It was very cheap. And of course, it's this giant thing that I had to then fit in my car. You know, I had to drive out somewhere to this, like, it wasn't even at the car wash. It was like somebody's farm that they had collected it from the abandoned car wash, and then they had it at their farm. And so it was this big production to get it home, get it stuck on the garage. And, you know, I say I'm trying to lower my property values, but the darn taxes keep going up no matter how ugly I make the property.
That's funny.
And I have a very accepting partner. My partner, Rachel, is she's very accepting of my nonsense, which is nice. You know, I can do silly things like that, and she's supportive of it. So that's,
well, that's what I was going to, well, a couple of thoughts on that. One, we can talk maybe more about the monorail project, cause that is crazy and fascinating. But just on that note, like, just even the videos you have in your garage, it's like, it looks like, look, like, you know, these old timers that have been tinkering around forever, and they've accumulated a lifetime's worth of random bolts and screws. That's what your garage looks like to me. So is that your entire own creation? Like, have you accumulated that in your lifetime, or did you buy this house from somebody who already had all that stuff set up and you're using it?
The house was pretty empty when we bought it. The garage had been a, I think it was a chainsaw sharpening business originally. And yeah, there's a whole backstory on the house. But when I moved in, when we moved into the house, the garage was kind of cut up into these weird little rooms for like the office and this guy's business. And I ripped down a lot of the walls and made it this big open space. But all that stuff in there, that is just my dumpster diving, estate sales, auctions. That is all kind of my collection. Like, I'm the guy that'll go to an estate sale and I will buy the coffee can of random nuts and bolts for a dollar, because, you know, I don't remember if I need a, you know, a 3/8, you know, I don't remember what bolt I need. So I will go through the coffee can later and say, oh, well, there's that one fits and this one fits. And I'll try to sort them out into rough sizes, but I am terrible at remembering the actual specifications for hardware. It's kind of, no, I have, you know, in that drawer, I have some of that size bolt and I need that size for this project. So yeah, all of that stuff is my very disorganized organization scheme, I guess, for my projects. So
very cool. Yeah. Well, and one of the videos I was watching that I really enjoyed was your like motorized rail car video series, I guess it maybe was, where you'd done a couple of different ones, but the one I watched was where you actually put a motor on it and you go through like 4 or 5 different motors just trying to get the dang thing to work and different wheel variations. Yeah. But it did work. Like, you're riding the rails. Yeah. And what I like about that, I think, is that I think for me, like, kind of from an engineering perspective and mentality, I really like reproducibility. So it's like, I want to like do something that can be done again. And because of that, sure, I usually tend to go for exact specifications, new stuff. But you go the opposite direction. You say, I have like these bolts that are all like, you know, I've got 4 bolts that match, so I can use these 4 bolts for the wheel or whatever. Honestly, I mean, I don't know, the video tells a certain story, but it seems like it's not like you're probably more productive and more successful with, and maybe kind of approaching it that way of saying like, look, I'm just going to like screw around with this thing and see if I can get it to work. Maybe that kind of opens up some freedom too for exploration and learning.
Yeah. I learn by trial and error a lot. I mean, I definitely try to do some planning. I try to do some amount of diagramming and at least sketching out what I think it's going to look like. But then, yeah, it'll be trial and error. It'll be, I have this motor, I have these wheels, I can get this device at Axeman Surplus, how can I put these together? And maybe it doesn't work, and maybe I have to go back and do, you know, another iteration and another iteration, and eventually it works well enough for my purposes, and maybe it's not, you know, people have asked me like, oh, how do I build it? What's the parts list to build this? And I say, I don't know, you know, I don't even, you know, I got this from the dumpster, and I got this from, and you'd never find all those parts again in one place. And people say, will you sell me this, you know, will you sell me this boat? Will you sell me this train? And I say, it's not, you know, I wouldn't want to sell it to another person. Like, I know all the quirks, I know the safety issues, I know how it works. And if I were to give it to another person, like, I sold a car once, my first car, by the time I sold that car, I feel sorry for the kid who bought it. You know, it was like, it was a push button start because somebody had stolen and wrecked the ignition. It was, you know, you'd pull a string to open the hood because the hood latch didn't work. And then you had to put a dowel in to hold the, you know, it was like, it was this car made of 1,000 junk pieces. And I sold it to some kid for $100 and he kept calling me, you know, he would call me a week later and say, oh, how do I do this? And, okay. Yeah. This is how, how do I do that? And I felt so sorry for the guy, but that's the kind of thing where by the time I'm done with a project, it's not really ready for the public. You know, it's not really ready for anyone else. Like, nobody else is going to want it. Nobody else is going to. So, yeah, I learn a lot, and I learn a lot about what not to do. And, I definitely trial and error. I make a lot of mistakes, and I'll try to show my mistakes in the video to say this is part of the process. This is part of me learning because I don't know what I'm doing. And I try, I always say I'm not an expert at this. I'm an enthusiastic amateur. I'm not, you know, I don't always know what I'm doing, but I'm willing to try to learn. So,
yeah, I really liked the video where you made a tank, a potato cannon tank with a paintball gun on it. And I think it was the last shot in the video where you try to go up the steps and it just like you fall over and the whole thing basically just falls apart, like almost comical, right? And it's like, yeah. I don't know, but the thumbnail, like, the picture of you with a helmet on driving that tank around, it looks so cool. But yeah, you can see how, you know, maybe from 20 feet away, it looks great, but you get a little bit closer and it is a little bit more jerry-rigged, but I don't know. That's the fun thing. That's the fun part for me, I think.
Yeah. And there's a lot of YouTubers who will tell you, like, yeah, you make it good enough for one video and then it never has to work again. And that's, you know, that's what some YouTubers do, is they make it, they show it off and then it is, you know, it is garbage after that, or it gets destroyed for the video. And that's closer to what I do. You know, a lot of people will do a very polished product, and I'm not good at, I get ADHD about it. I get to a certain point and I'm bored with it, and I don't always polish it. I don't always finish it. So, and I don't, you know, I'll keep stuff around. I'll maybe reuse it for another project later, but yeah, that's a lot of what I do is good enough for my purposes. And then maybe I move on to the next thing.
So. Yeah. I took a wood shop class in college, and the professor, he would say, you know, cause like, he's like a master woodworker and I'm like, don't know anything. So comparatively, my work looks like garbage. And he would say, it's good enough for who it's for, right? You know, and it was like kind of funny, but yeah, it is good enough for who it's for, good enough for what it's for. I was kind of curious though, because you, like, I don't know, you say that you're ADD and you're jumping all over the place, but I also have sensed like an incredible amount of perseverance in your videos about like, yeah, even with that rail car thing where it's like you're on your fifth motor and like drivetrain assembly and whatever. And it's like, I guess I'm curious, like, how many videos never come out? Like, how many times do you like have the footage? Because that's the other thing for me, is like, it's one thing to like go through all these design iterations and get something and film it, but then you have to sit down and like go through the footage and put it together and make it coherent. So is that a problem at all? Like, how many videos never even see the light of day? Or is it pretty much you have a workflow and a system that works well for you now, and you're able to kind of just put stuff out?
There are some that never get finished. My workflow is probably terrible. I usually am working on like six things at once. Partly because I'll work on something and then maybe I'll get stuck and I won't know, well, what do I do next? And then I have to think about it, or maybe I have to order a part. Maybe I say, okay, I know I need this piece from Amazon that I can't find in a trash can. So I'll have to order a part, set it aside, and work on something else. And some things definitely like fail completely, and I kind of push them aside. I say, okay, this has got to a point where I can't make it work. Like, I have this idea, I can't get to this idea, and it's maybe not interesting enough for a video. And sometimes I will, like, if I've given up long enough, sometimes I'll put those together and I'll just say, here's a compilation of my failures from the last couple of years or whatever. And so maybe they'll see the light of day that way. But I do definitely, I have a whole bunch of videos that I've just marked in progress in my raw video hard drive that they're in progress, but maybe I'll finish them, maybe I won't. Maybe I know how to finish them, maybe I don't know, maybe I just need time. The editing, I actually enjoy editing. I like to sit down and edit stuff. I actually, that's the only part that I would say I'm still not an expert, but I actually have training in. I took a couple of video production classes in high school. I did a little bit in college. I never did that professionally. I guess I'm doing it professionally now, but I have some experience with, like, you know, Adobe Premiere, even I think Avid, back when people used Avid. And now I use Shotcut because it's free, it's open source, and it's basically the same as Premiere. But yeah, I enjoy sitting down and editing. I like to sit down and make something into a story, into a video. And I've evolved a little bit with that. I used to be basically, I would film, if I filmed an hour of video, I would get that into 10 minutes approximately. And a lot of people said, well, that's really good. And nowadays I maybe cut more. I maybe film 5 hours and I get it into, you know, 20 minutes. So I'm being a little more selective with what I show, and I'm being a little more polished, perhaps. I know I'm rambling here. I'm getting off topic. You said ADHD, and you said I tend to finish things or push through, and that was a big reason why I started the channel. I was always doing these projects. I was always doing stuff like this, like the monorail. That was before YouTube. A lot of my potato cannons, a lot of my boat projects, those were all before I was doing a YouTube channel. And a lot of the reason for the YouTube channel was to have an external motivation to finish, to say, I am actually going to get this project to a point where I'm comfortable enough to show it off, versus, oh, it never gets done. It gets thrown in the corner of the garage. And the YouTube channel was a way to say, I'm going to finish these projects. I'm going to use all this junk that I have hoarded. I'm not just going to hoard it. I'm going to use it, do something with it, show it off. And that was the whole reason for the YouTube channel. I wasn't setting out to make money. I wasn't setting out to get popular. I just wanted to have this way to motivate myself to use the stuff, to do the projects, to get the projects somewhat finished or where I'm happy with them. Like I said, it was just kind of luck that it got to the point where I'm willing to risk it being my only source of income at this point. So
very cool. That's really, really inspiring. I don't know. What's the deal with leaf blowers, man? What is the deal with, like, gas powered leaf blowers? Like, there, I think about this sometimes. I think about, like, there will be a day that's the last time I ever hear a gas powered leaf blower, and I won't know it. I won't know it at the time, but I don't know. Do I think I'll ever think back and miss them? Because I don't think I will, man. Like, I don't understand what the deal with gas-powered leaf blowers is. And probably eventually, when they're all dead and not used and illegal or whatever, there'll be a Save It for Parts YouTube video where you take 100 gas-powered leaf blowers and make a hoverboat or something with it, right?
Yeah. I tried to use, not gas, I used an electric one to try to move some sand, and it failed miserably. I've never understood this idea of having a spotless lawn and blowing your leaves, I guess, into someone else's lawn. I don't know. I usually just run the mower over the leaves and let them mulch the corner of the yard. I don't care usually. I am terrible at having a yard. I will cut the grass when it gets to the point of, like, you can't really see the rabbits in the grass anymore. And I have neighbors who are out there every day with, like, nail clippers, and they have just the perfect lawn. And I'm here with the, like, you know, the jungle, and I'm sure I'm driving the property values down, but the city hasn't come after me yet, so that's good.
Yeah, they're pretty, I mean, I don't know. It's like, you make it sound like your yard, I don't know, looks terrible, but you have your outside of your house and your videos and stuff, and it definitely looks like the Save It for Parts YouTube channel yard, which I think is cool and good, but they seem to be pretty well, even again in the rail car video where I don't even know where you were testing that on the old abandoned tracks, but then, like, the cops showed up and they didn't even kick you out.
Yeah. That was a park, and it was the park police. And they said, because it's a public park, the tracks are on public land. So there are some other tracks where I've gone, and it's a gray area for some of them, because the railroad will often still own that property. Sometimes it's city-owned property, and I've definitely, you know, I never go on active track. I never go anywhere that's still connected to a rail line where there would be trains, which I always stress that, and I always get comments that say, oh, even in a band, you know, there, sure, there's these trees growing up through the track, and it's cut off, but you're going to get run over, and then you're going to get arrested, and then you're going to get run over some more, and it's like, well, no, but yeah, I keep, you know, I try not to be a role model. I try to say, don't do this at home. Don't build this and go out on an active track. You want to, if you're doing this, you go somewhere that is never going to be used again, basically. So,
which is, I mean, like, it almost seems like prerequisite knowledge to be able to pull off a pro, like, and that's what I mean. And I mean, you even talk about in Funter Bay, there being the abandoned rail. I think you said it was an electric locomotive, and then, that you went out to Nevada and saw, that I noticed on your blog, you went and visited that old train. But even like in your most recent, like, gold mine exploration video, you were just like very clear, like, we're here with permission. And there's almost like an implication that it's like, look, I grew up here and I kind of understand some of the risks, and I've seen people get hurt, and I've seen, you know, I know a thing or two about how to be safe here. Whereas, you know, the average looky-loo with a selfie stick waving it around, not looking where they're walking. You showed the crevice. Like, it's like, I was like, imagine just, yeah, like, if you're not looking, you fall down 30 feet, like, that it could probably kill you. So there definitely seems to be some street smarts that you have with all of this.
I mean, some of it's common sense, and I feel like that's, yeah, there's some common sense, even, you know, like, about trespassing. If you're, because I enjoy exploring old mines, and I'll go out, I go out to kind of your neck of the woods. I go out to Death Valley and around Las Vegas, and there's a bunch of abandoned mines, and if they're on public property, or if you have permission, then yeah, there's no problem really legally, but you still have to be safe. You still have to be aware of your surroundings, that, yeah, the safety standards in the 1880s were very different than today. And you can find situations that are still very dangerous. So yeah, there's a lot of common sense with that. And with property ownership, with trespassing, you want to be very aware of, is this private property? Is there, you know, are there signs? Are there, you know, is it obvious that somebody doesn't want you on this land, or are they okay with you being on this land if you're respectful and aren't, you know, breaking things, you aren't stealing things? And I've run in a kind of the other direction, where the property owner has no common sense, and they have this massive attractive nuisance and no signs. Like, there's one, for example, I was driving around down in Iowa in, I forget what town, I probably shouldn't name the town or people will go down there, but there was this little town in Iowa, and there were just train cars. Like, this guy had all these train cars kind of out in this field, all overgrown, and it looked totally abandoned and really cool stuff, and just right off the road. So I said, cool, you know, stop and walk around, and no signs, nothing saying it's private property. And eventually some guy showed up in a pickup truck and started threatening to call the cops. And I said, hey man, how do I know? I don't know, this is private property. You should put some signs up. Like, if you don't want people here, like, you're going to get people here. You are going to get kids. You're going to get the Instagram kids. You're going to get rail fans. You're going to get people that are interested in railroad history. Like, I'm not there to spray paint. I'm just there to, I think these are cool old train cars and you should make a museum. And, you know, he grumbled about it a bit and let us go. And it was like, you gotta be aware of that stuff, both as a person interested in old history and as the owner of old history. Like, you're going to get curious people poking around. So.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And there is, like, you know, there is truth to, like, it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. But if the permission is requisite upon you being safe, meaning, like, if I ask permission to go on the abandoned Alaska gold mine, and they're like, yeah, just so you know, there's like a 30-foot crevice that is, like, just here.
Right.
Yeah. Like, then I fall down that. I don't know that. Then it's, I think out here we probably deal with it more with tourism and the, like, national parks, you know. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of the Death Valley Germans. You mentioned Death Valley, but the Death Valley Germans, there's a guy that wrote up he was part of the search and rescue operation that was trying to figure out what happened to them. And even out here in Zion National Park, it's pretty close by. And, you know, even a couple of years ago, there was a lady who was, like, lost in the park for days, but she was, it just kind of, honestly, I think a lot of times, things that impair people's judgment come into play. So that's, like, a big part of it, is, like, there's one thing if, like, you have common sense and there's a 30-foot crevice, but if you're, like, drunk and have common sense and there's a 30-foot crevice, it's like all bets are off, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen that where, you know, I've seen that where people, even at, even driving, you know, driving out to some of these points, you can get in a lot of trouble, of course, being drunk or just not knowing the road, not knowing how to get out to some of the spots around there out in the desert. So, yeah.
Very interesting. I guess I was kind of just curious. Well, I wrote down this spherical display. Honestly, I think the spherical display is probably my favorite video that you have made because I have this fantasy, and I've asked friends and family members and engineering friends and people that are creative. I have a fantasy of building myself a wizard orb. And people say, what is a wizard orb? And I say, great question. You tell me, what is a wizard orb? If there was a wizard orb that existed, what would it be? And so far, your spherical display is the closest I've seen to a wizard orb. I don't know that there's much of a discussion to have there. You made a video about it. It's this crazy product that existed. It's kind of like a, who even know, like, do you know why, like, was it an educational thing or was it a scientific thing?
Yeah, and I think you can still get them for schools. Like this one, I think came from a museum, or it was a university surplus auction, so it was something to do with the university. And yeah, it's a, if people haven't seen it, it's this basically digital globe with a projector in the bottom. So it's a spherical screen, and you can project the Earth onto it. You can project like the night sky. You can project all, you know, anything spherical basically. And I have seen people make them on YouTube. So a bunch of people in the comments of that video sent links to, there were some DIY ones, there were smaller tabletop ones. Apparently there is a company in Japan that makes one about, you know, household globe sized, where mine is, you know, 2 feet in diameter or thereabouts. But yeah, so, and I need to do a follow-up video on it because a lot of the comments people asked, well, can you play Doom on it? That's always the first question. How is it made? You know, how would you recreate this? Can you do it with modern video instead of this, like, you know, Windows Vista laptop that's running the thing? So I should do a follow-up video and try to address some of those questions. Yeah. And it's, right now it's just sitting in my basement along with all my kind of to-do pile. But yeah, that is a fun, it's a fun product, and I think you can still buy them if you're like a museum or a school, but you're going to pay a fortune for it at that.
Have an extra $20,000 laying around. Yeah. I was curious. I noticed that it looked like you're using like a 360 cam for some of your footage. And so I was kind of curious if that would play on it or what that would look like.
I don't know. I'll have to try that because YouTube has, I think, a cooperation with this Insta360 where you can basically just drop their raw 360 video onto YouTube and it'll work. Like you can pan around with your mouse, or if you have a smart TV, I guess you can pan around with the remote, or people said you just put on a VR helmet. And I just filmed one yesterday. Actually, I filmed one at X-Man Surplus with the 360 camera. So I'll have to see if I can play that on the globe. That would be really interesting. I would have to run that through maybe, again, some other software. And that's something I am not, even though I went to school for computer science, I am very weak at programming. I'm very bad at programming. I can hack my way through a Python script, a very amateurish Python script, but to get a three-dimensional video transformation onto a three-dimensional projector, I would need some help with that. And people offered help, which I need to follow up on as well. So, yeah.
Very cool. So I guess maybe taking it, well, I don't know. Like, what do you want to talk about? Like, what have you been fascinated with recently? What are the things you've been nerding out about? Even if it's just like a random article you read, like, I don't expect to see a video about this, but I'm just talking more to Gabe, the guy that runs Save It for Parts, who's been Save It for Parts since he was a little kid. What would you like to talk about?
Oh boy. I mean, like I said, my interests are all over the place. I guess I you mentioned the monorail. That's something that it didn't start as a YouTube project because that was kind of before I did YouTube, but I got a little too interested in monorails perhaps after that. I tend to get kind of monofocused on one thing for a while, but yeah, the monorail was one where this is one of those things where it has all this backstory. There's kind of all this lore behind all of my projects. So my friend owns this property called Sandland, which is, he bought this property to dig tunnels. It's a Jordan sandstone, which is, I think, very similar to some stuff you guys have out there in some of like the national monuments and stuff. It's this easily carved sandstone that stays stable. Once you carve out a tunnel, it's basically stable forever. unless a massive amount of water comes through. So he's digging tunnels in this property. He has no plans for the surface. He thinks the surface is boring. So I was coming out and helping him camping out. We set up a tent, and I said, you know, setting up a tent every weekend is really a lot of work. What if we got something out there like a jet fuselage? And all the jet fuselages are down in your neck of the woods because the desert. So you can't buy those here, but you could buy a monorail here because our local Minnesota zoo had just shut down their monorail, and they were selling this train, three trains, actually. They had three trains of cars. They put it on some obscure Minnesota auction website that nobody uses, and they didn't get any bids, and they were at a loss for how to sell this. So I called them up, I made an offer, and we got a monorail train, and then spent about 7 or 8 times what I paid for it to get it out there, set it all up again as a train. We don't have any track, but we have the whole train set up, and each car it's about the size of a small camper, basically, or like a small RV. So each car is like a different little cabin, and so people who volunteer out there at Sandland can stay in the monorail train, and we can use it as a campsite, and then we can go help our friend dig, or we can do other projects. So I got very into monorails, you know, then researching, like, okay, what are other monorails around the country and around the world? And I talked to somebody in Australia who bought the Sydney monorail when they shut down, and you know, she was very into monorails too. And so I had made all these weird, interesting connections with weird monorail fans who it's a very odd little subculture of the world, I guess. But yeah, that's one that I still work on that. I still kind of maintain it, and we try to use it as our little off-grid cabin. But it's a fiberglass cabin instead of a wood cabin.
So what is a monorail?
It's a little train. Ours is it's a train, but it runs on one track on one. Ours originally ran on this box, basically section of box steel, just wrapped, you know, the wheels would wrap around it.
Okay. And almost like an I-beam kind of a thing. And like, yeah. Oh, I'm almost imagining like a roller coaster.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I don't know where it is. I have a monorail book around here somewhere I could show you, but it's probably on the other bookshelf. Yeah. So like, if you think Disneyland or Seattle, or I think Las Vegas has a monorail that I don't remember if it really goes anywhere, but it's like a futuristic train that just runs on one track, usually an elevated track. And they're all the rage. Every few years, some city builds one, and then it always kind of, you know, fails to be profitable. And they're kind of a weird novelty. And ours was a novelty zoo ride. It was it was like an attraction at the zoo. And when they built it, they didn't really build it. You couldn't really see the animals very well from it, and it had other issues, and they never budgeted it very well, so it never made any money. And so we ended up with it basically as this kind of thing that they were trying to get rid of, that they decided was no longer profitable.
So it's like it's basically just a little train.
Yeah, and ours is I don't want to get too off topic, but this is that book that I was mentioning, and I've talked to the guy. He's passed away now, but I talked to the fellow that wrote this book, and I think, yeah, I have a picture in here actually of ours. So this is what my monorail looked like operation at the zoo. And it's you know, each little car seats about in this particular one, each car would seat about 12 people maybe. So it's not as big as the one in Las Vegas or the one at Disneyland, but it's enclosed. It's a little enclosed train. So
interesting. Yeah. I mean, I've been on a couple of interesting trains. I think one of the most interesting trains I've been on was in Mexico City, riding their public train, which I believe is unique because it actually has rubber tires. So even though it's like a traditional train, I don't know if this is a thing, but it runs on rubber, like wheels, essentially, to just drive on the tracks. Kind of, I guess, similar to your rail car that you made.
Yeah, I think Paris has one like that too. Really? So there are some metro systems that have rubber tires. And this, technically, mine had, don't know if I have a picture of it. Technically, it had rubber tires underneath that would ride on that I-beam, and then kind of wrap around to grip the sides. And that, we didn't get any of the motors. So it had all these like three-phase 480-volt motors, which I couldn't do. We don't have power out at Sandland, so we could not do anything with three-phase 480. And they added a lot of weight, so we actually had them remove the motors, And we just took basically the car body, the fiberglass shell, which is all we needed. And that was easier to move, lighter. I have some other parts and pieces of it around, but yeah, as the train, it basically is just a static, it's a static cabin. It wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't move even if we had track, because we'd have to put those motors back in. So,
okay. And then you have it out of Sandland. I would suggest, if people are just kind of curious to hear what Gabe is talking about with Sandland, he has a lot of really good videos that are filmed at Sandland. He also has some good videos that are about Sandland. There's also, what is the website, for Sandland? Can you refresh me?
Yeah, the owner's website is tunnelcity.com.
Tunnelcity.com.
So all one word, tunnelcity.com.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's kind of, we're bad at updating it, but we have kind of the about. We have some photos. We have a map. He doesn't usually want people to know right where it is, because, again, the looky-loos, the Instagram kids. So if people are interested in volunteering, if they want to come out and dig some tunnels, the owner likes to vet people first a little bit. Yeah. But his contact info is on there. If somebody wants to dig some tunnels, it's I like it. I think it's probably weird, and a lot of people think it's weird, but I really enjoy exploring tunnels, and then being able to kind of design and build your own is a lot of fun too. So
yeah, there. Well, I'm thinking, because in Utah, I believe, and I don't know if this is technically true, but I believe that like the oldest remaining human built structure, like remnant of human civilization in North America, is out here in Utah. At least it's one of them. Okay. Out somewhere near Lake Powell, which is like a sandstone cave that they carved out. It still exists. I mean, it is what it is. You've seen a lot of sandstone caves before, I assume. We've got a lot of really beautiful sandstone rock out here. And so I'm assuming it's kind of a similar thing, but the Sandland is interesting because it's actually underground. Like it's not like in, it's yeah. Is that very safe? Like, I guess it is. They're structurally safe, or like when you're in there, you know, with a jackhammer and stuff, they don't collapse.
And that is a question I get asked all the time. So our sandstone, and there are a couple kinds of sandstone, but our particular sandstone basically stays stable as long as you arch the ceiling, or you have a small enough tunnel. Like, you can have a flat ceiling if it's a like 3 foot wide tunnel. But the bigger you go, the kind of more you want to arch it. And that stays stable. There are some mines around here, like commercial mines that do, I think it was frack sand, and they have like, you know, 100 foot tall tunnels, 100 foot wide. And as long as they have that kind of cathedral shape, it stays naturally stable. And it does take quite a bit of effort to smash these out. We have, like you said, jackhammers. We've used kind of like stone saws. We've used various tools to cut this stuff out, because it's a bedrock. It's a rock. It's not just sand. There are other safety concerns. You know, there's we do run some fans to keep the airflow moving. We have three entrances that it kind of naturally ventilates. And then we have done some radon testing. We've done other air quality testing. And then when we are actually digging, we all wear respirators because silica sand, you can get something called silicosis, which used to be a problem in old-timey mines. It's like the black lung that miners would get, but it's for, you know, sand in your lungs. So when you're digging, you have to wear a bunch of safety equipment. And of course, I usually wear a hard hat just in case something falls. I've never really had anything fall on my head, but if I'm digging overhead, I can have some chunks come down. And I wear ear protection, you know, face shield, eye protection. So basically full PPE, because we are mining. We're doing essentially industrial mining, but it's just for hobby purposes. So
and your so shirt, for people listening, he's wearing a shirt that says OSHA approved. So, you know, Gabe's always going to be 100% kosher with everything OSHA would like him to do, right?
Oh yeah, I sell these as a joke, and OSHA hasn't sued me yet, so I do sell these on my merch page on YouTube. So
I will leave a link to that in the show notes for people that want to get OSHA certified. I'm not going to say that. They would like to get an OSHA approved shirt as a to support Gabe's channel. Okay, go ahead.
I have stickers too, so you can slap them on your project to make OSHA your project approved. Safer.
Slap it on there. We're good. It's safe. What you mentioned that you like caving a lot. what kind of caves have you been in, and what's, do you have like a preference? Or I've been in lava tubes, I've been in limestone caves. I've probably been in some sandstone, alcove kind of things, but what, do you have any, what, I don't know, growing up in Alaska, was there a certain style of cave or?
So growing up, it was mines. It was artificial, yeah. You know, gold mines, silver mines. There are some natural limestone caves, but they're all mostly on another island. So I didn't have as much exposure to natural caves when I was a kid. We just go in the gold mines. And so I guess my preference is kind of artificial tunnels, both for, usually you can stand up, where natural cave, you're often doing a lot of crawling. There's a lot of interesting stuff in mines. You know, there's old equipment, there's rail tracks, there's little ore cars, and just kind of seeing how they'd design stuff, how they'd build these tunnels. So my preference is probably lean towards artificial tunnels and caves. I call them caves. A cave should be technically a natural formation, and anything else is either a mine or a tunnel. But down here in Minnesota, we do have a lot of sandstone, and there are old like brewery caves, which again, they call them caves, but it'll be where we'd get a lot of German immigrants in Minnesota, and they would come over here from Germany, immediately dig a cave to cool their beer, build a brewery on the surface. And basically any little town in Minnesota has a brewery and often has a cave under it. And these are fun to poke around in and explore, again, with either, you know, with permission or safe.
Yeah.
You don't want to go trespassing in those, but, and you don't want to, you know, go in any that are unstable, but, like when I go out to Death Valley or Panamint Valley, there are lots of old mines out there, and they're in great condition because it's so dry. Like in Alaska, everything rots really fast. Like I've shown in some of my videos, everything gets overgrown, everything gets buried in moss, everything rusts. So the mines and the remnants, the artifacts in Alaska are kind of temporary, because after 100 years, you can't really tell what it is. Where some of these other spots that are like a desert climate, you go in there 100 years later and the tracks are still shiny. The mine cars still move around. You know, the tools still work. Everything is in beautiful condition. And again, you want to be respectful and not pilfer that stuff, because you want the next person to enjoy it. Yep. So that's the kind of thing I really enjoy.
It makes me think about, I recently did a kind of a solo overlanding trip through the western Utah desert, kind of the area out by Oak City where I mentioned. There's a town called Delta, nice. Utah out there that has a giant coal-firing power plant that serves most of the power for LA County, interestingly enough, like Los Angeles. But out there, I went into Lehman Cave in Great Basin National Park, this big limestone cave. Okay. And it was interesting because there was one part of the tour where we went in a kind of a bigger open area. And on the ceiling, it looked like graffiti. It's like just like everywhere. There's like a ton of graffiti all over, like almost every square inch was covered, and it was black. And the tour guide was telling us that these are actually from before it was a national park, before it was privately owned. People from the nearby town would come in and they would be given a candle. And they'd say, you know, if you don't come back out within 24 hours, we'll come look for you. So these people would climb in here with the candles, shimmy on their bellies, whatever it is. And then, they would leave their initials or a little message on the inside. And she described them as being inscriptions is what they call them. So she was kind of, the point was that this is just as much as part of the natural history at this point as the cave itself is, as whether you think that that's fortunate or unfortunate. So it kind of makes me think about that as well, where, yeah, just because something is, again, I grew up, I'm a Boy Scout, Eagle Scout, leave no trace is a big part of what I try to do, which doesn't just mean pack your garbage out. It also means leave things as they are. Don't put your initials in things. Take a picture. We have phones. You can take a video. Kind of just try to leave things alone. Even out here in the desert where things do stay around a lot longer, if you know where to look. But with that, it's kind of interesting, because with that, it kind of has its own set of hazards and issues of being in the desert. But what is it about? So you go to Death Valley. I know we're getting close on time here, so I want to be respectful, but I want to hear more about Death Valley, because you've mentioned that a couple of times.
Yeah. So I still have relatives out in California, so we've been out there to visit sometimes, and then I've gone to a couple events out in that area, in Panamint Valley, Death Valley, for underground exploring and mine exploring, and Yeah, I really like it. I mean, it's hot, but it's a dry heat, as they say. So I enjoy camping out there and exploring some of these old places. And just doing your own research. Like the events that I've gone to, they don't give you a map. They don't give you, like, they'll give you a campsite, basically. You show up at this campsite, you know, they'll have a party maybe, but they say, hey, do your own research. Find out what's around. Find out how to get there. And maybe if you seem, you know, if you seem respectful and cool, maybe somebody will show you where the good stuff is. And it's, again, it's a community. It's kind of a fun, temporary community. But again, this is part of what I was talking about, like online and then in person, like an online community of kind of mine enthusiasts, historians, off-road 4x4 folks who are coming at it from different walks of life, but coming together at, you know, a camp out and doing some of the same things and supporting each other. And that's part of what I like about it. Not just the history, not just the exploring, but also kind of the community aspect is a lot of fun.
Very cool. So, okay. So you're part of some groups that organize events out there and do things. Yeah.
Briefly,
I think that is a really good point. There has to be, I don't know, the human connection is very important. And it's a lot more fun to talk to somebody online that you have a relationship with, or, I mean, again, it can go both ways. But I think that's a really apt point about communities. So Gabe, we're just going to wrap it up here. I wanted to say thank you so much for joining me on the Interrowing podcast. You're probably the biggest guest that I've had so far. So I just really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. It's been really fun, really enlightening. Is there anything you want to, I will leave links to all of your channel, your website, your merch store. I will leave all your links in my, in the show notes so people can look at that. But is there anything else you want to kind of plug or say that you want to get off your chest right now?
I can't think of anything at the moment. I'm sure there's something, but I'm I can't think of it on the spot. So thank you for having me. I appreciate the time here, and excuse me, I'm getting a little hoarse, so this is a good time to wrap up, I guess. But yeah, thank you very much for the invitation, and it's been fun talking to you.
Interrobang.